Hey, we are on. We're on.
Welcome to Read Science. Today's topic is dogs. Humans have lived and worked with dogs for at least a few tens of thousands of years. And as everyone knows who lives with a dog will tell you, we are still far from understanding what dogs are thinking or what they're capable of doing. Today, my co-host, Joanne Manister, and I will be talking with two authors whose recent books make lots of fascinating contributions to that conversation. First, let me introduce Kat Warren, author of What the Dog Knows, The Science and Wonder of Working Dogs, which I thought was an engaging and really enlightening book about her experiences raising, let's say, a headstrong German Shepherd named Solo, and their training together for his career as a cadaver dog, and more widely talking about dogs who work with their noses and what those noses are capable of. Kat teaches at North Carolina State University. She started her career as a newspaper reporter, accidentally discovered that she liked teaching at a university, got her advanced degree at the University of Illinois, Joanne's current home, by the way, and then finally settled into being a university professor teaching reporting, editing, and science journalism. What the Dog Knows, she claims, is her first book, and it's quite a splendid debut. Welcome to the program, Kat.
Well, thank you, Jeff and Joanne. Thanks for having me. It's just a delight. And hi, Virginia.
Hi, Kat. Good to see you, too. I loved your book.
Thank you. Ditto.
And I would love to introduce Virginia Morrell. And I have had the pleasure of speaking with her because she was one of the authors from the Summer Science Reading poll that Scientific American held. And then we took the winners and we had a nice conversation in a Google Hangout on air. So Virginia has written a book called Animal Wise, and I'm seeing some little glitches in the video here, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And you know, the funny thing is you look online and one of the images is a dog instead of the monkey, and you can explain that.
Yes,
well.
I can.
We're thinking that these two would be a great pair because what the dog knows takes a look at, you know, how do we train these dogs and you know, what is the science behind it? Training these dogs to train their behavior so that they can help us, find dead bodies and that interplay. And Virginia's book talks way more about lots of animals, not just dogs. So we go beyond the dog and cat realm, and we talk about primates and dolphins and birds and just about any animal you can imagine where there's some research about animal cognition and animal emotion. So Virginia, welcome. Well, let me read a little bit about you so people...
Thank you.
So you are actually an acclaimed science writer, so your name is everywhere. You're the author of 4 books, and you have written for Science and National Geographic and New York Times Magazine, Smithsonian, and the list goes on and on. And you are your 2004 National Geographic article on climate change was a finalist for Best Environmental Article from the Society of Environmental Journalists. And then you talk about your animals at Psychology Today as well. So you are you have degrees in English. So you aren't a science person, but you write about science.
Well, and I think of myself as a science person, a literary science person. I growing up intended to be a biologist, but because I could write and I loved to read, I got pointed in the direction of humanities, and then I came to my senses after graduating and figured out a way to then use my writing abilities to tell people about the wonder of science.
You know, that's interesting. We run into both people who are great scientists who can write, but very compelling books, I find, are written by writers who happen to just be fascinated with science and have found a niche market there, and that now would be Kat as well. So we've got people from the English, the literature side of things here.
And I did do a master's in environmental science just to get the word science. One of my degrees.
Well, when you think of people like Carl Zimmer and Jennifer Ouellette, for instance, who are also well-known science writers, their background is English and literature and writing. So, but they are some of our best science writers out there.
Yes. Well, once you know how to tell a good story, nothing, the subject changes, the vocabulary changes, but if you know how to tell a good story, that doesn't change.
The story is really important, and I think Kat's book exemplified very well for me a trend that I can approve of in what we call might call science writing, which is not the science exposition of popular books that I knew in my youth, but has become a more integrated storytelling, biography, but none of which, you know, as you're telling the story, not eschewing the science or trying to avoid it, but integrating it comfortably into what's going on without apology, I think is the great new trend, and it's the thing that's really going to do the important work of sort of integrating science into people's everyday lives, which is what Joanne and I are about, and I think your book really does well too.
Oh, thank you. And I think it's really interesting. I think Virginia does this, and as I was rereading Animal Wise Virginia, and I had read it once right a number of months ago, and then looking back at it, and I was just thinking that every chapter had this this narrative, right? This reigning idea that helped move the story. So whether it was the chapter on dogs and using, and I don't know if I'm mispronouncing her name, but Frederica Range's work with the wolves, right?
Yeah, Frederica Range, yeah.
Frederica Range, whose work I admire so greatly, or the chapter on elephants and memory, just letting that story both emerge, but then also reign, right? I think it takes, and I'm not saying I did it very well, but I do think it takes an enormous amount of discipline because it is so easy for us to sort of prioritize the science and forget about the fact that to make people care about the science, we really have to bring this stuff in, and then you remember post facto, oh, this is also what I care about, right?
Exactly.
The relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it was one of the things when I wrote my book that I wanted to do was to explore the relationship between the scientist and the animal they studied. So even with the ant researcher, I was very curious about how he felt about his ants, and I thought the most telling detail was at the end, you know, he collects colonies of little rock ants that live in crevices and rocks on the coast of England, and then he takes them to his lab and he has to paint all 200 individuals in a colony because otherwise the ladies would clean each other. They all want to smell alike. And then he gives them what he calls challenge tests, and he's found out from that they're real estate appraisers. They can tell how tall a ceiling they need, how much actual physical space they need to set up their little concentric circles, and where to put the eggs, and how many entrances they need. They know he knows that they do not want any dead ants in the neighborhood, which is probably wise on their part. Something bad happened here. And so when he's done doing all of these tests, I said, what do you do with the ants? And he said, well, I take them home. He said, I put the colonies in shoeboxes because they fit in sort of jewel size petri dishes, and I take them home, and they have their little dishes with food and water and little fly carcasses. He takes them home, and then and I said, well, how many do you have? And they're stored in shoeboxes. And he said, well, let's just say I can't get the car into the garage anymore. So, I think every scientist I met had some kind, they had an emotional connection with the animals they studied, most certainly. There's no question of that.
But that still serves well the purpose of talking about the science versus being science biography and focusing on the scientist as an eccentric or the scientist as the world's greatest genius that, you know, you could never be like. It turns the science into real people and uses the scientist then as what the vehicle for conveying in a natural setting the science that's going on and generating interest. Do you discuss that with your students? Is that a topic, Kat? that, yes. that comes up, that
it,
approach?
It's such a fascinating thing trying to persuade students to disrespect the science by foregrounding the story, right? They come in and they want to tell the driest of dry stories about the science because that's what they think is the important thing, and that they have to get the science right, of course, but that they have to make the people and the things come alive, and that very often it's these emotional connections, it's the storytelling narrative that at its heart actually counts not only for the reader, but also what you find out, and I'm sure that Virginia and Jeff and Joanne know this as well, it counts for the scientist as well, mm-hmm. right?
It's also, I think, how students actually remember when they read, say, a scientific book like yours, it's sort of a scientific memoir in a way, that what sticks out are the things that you did with your dog, and those are the bits of science that they're actually going to remember, and I think the public at large does that as well when they read books such as mine or yours. I know people really love it when I tell stories about Alex the gray parrot, and they love to hear that I heard him speak and can do sort of an imitation mm-hmm. of Alex, and that tends to really stay with people. They'll comment on that, and the fact that Alex had a mind in his brain, and he was able to mm-hmm. then use words to distinguish between abstract concepts such as shape and color.
Yes.
But all of those specific narratives about characters underline the science that's going on. They reinforce whatever notion is at hand. I had some little note, and one fact from What the Dog Knows that surprised me at first when I read it, and then lined up with, you know, all of the things we were understanding and talking about during the training, the early training you were having with Solo, was the idea that every search has to end with a success, even if you don't find the body, because the dog has to be paid for his work.
Yes.
Well, of course, but, and, you know, that ties so many nice things up, and also explains, you know, Solo's excitement about the Kong at the end of a search, or the pull toy, and how that fits in with what he believes he's doing, how he's framing the whole issue. It's a story that's telling, but it's telling in both the narrative way as a narrative detail, and also a scientific way, and that's great. We love to see the science integrated that way.
Right. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kat.
Oh, no. I just briefly, what's interesting about this is, of course, over time, as dogs get more experienced, you can vary rewards and timing, and mm-hmm. you know, experienced dogs build up so that they don't need rewarding, you know, every 5 minutes or every few seconds as a puppy does. And I think that one of the things you learn as you go on is that the dogs learn to self-reward. I know that Virginia mm-hmm. knows herding dogs, right? And the degree yes. to which when you watch herding dogs herd sheep, you realize they aren't doing it for the handler. They are doing it because they are having a ton of fun with the herding itself, and that yep. notion of self-reward, I think, happens with any advanced dog, that at a certain point they're just in love with doing what they do mm-hmm. for the work of it. And it's true that you need to at a certain point intervene, as you say, and this was early on, and this was like his very first search where I blew it by not bringing along a way that I could reward him easily.
Mm-hmm. Isn't a lot of the reward also just the fact that the dog is getting to work with you? That was one of the points that mm-hmm. the dog researchers that I met in Hungary, who really launched the field of dog cognition studies, they emphasized, you know, that we brought the dog into our lives in order to have their minds to work alongside ours. And I just love that image, you know, that the dog is with us. It's as Adam McCloskey said to me, he said, your dog is not a lamp, you know, it has a mind in its brain, and you should be using that and taking advantage of it, and the dog mm-hmm. wants to do things with you. That's why we have dogs with us, is to take advantage of that additional mind.
Writing about it that way as a reward that closes out and pays the dog in a sense for what's been going on is different, isn't it, from the way we would have read or written about it 30 years ago, where we'd say, well, the dog doesn't know what he's doing. The dog does what you've trained him to do so that so that he can get the treat at the end. And I mean, thanks to this, what you're talking about now, Virginia, and these things, if we watch them, we know that the dog is enjoying this. That's part of the whole thing. The dog is doing something that the dog is somehow, that we don't comprehend, thinking about.
Yes.
And the reward, yes, the reward is important, but I think calling it payment for the work, in addition to the enjoyment of doing the work, it was a really... subtle but significant shift in viewpoint that about how we're learning about these things.
Yes, yes. And dogs do more than work for paychecks, obviously. As Virginia said, it's all a whole subtle relationship, etc. But I think it's important for people to remember that, and I think that people easily forget that dogs are doing this and working for us partly when we keep it fun. They're not just inherently doing it for an abstract love of us, right? Mm-hmm. Part mm-hmm. of the joy in the building intensity is because, as Virginia says, the relationship that you build with the dog and vice versa, which mm-hmm. brings in that those layers. And that notion that a dog would simply do what it does simply to please us time after time and keep on doing that, I think is... the wrong way to approach it, right? I think it's so important to always keep in mind that the dog is out there to have fun, right?
Yeah.
They're having fun, and then there's also the part of them wanting to be with us. That was another study that the Hungarians did, and they took puppies that were just a couple of months old and gave them a test between dog puppies and wolf puppies and presented the dogs with a choice, the puppies with a choice of either going to a human or to a dog, and the dog puppies actually chose the human almost every time, whereas the wolf puppies would crawl to the dog, you know, the German Shepherd type or the wolf type dog. Mm-hmm. So there was a real difference in what these two animals, even though they're so closely related, see as where they belong. And dogs, from the time they're puppies, see us as, Adam would say, as their ecological niche. You know, that's mm-hmm. just where they're meant to be, is with us. And so the Hungarians decided early on that they were going to study the dogs in their natural habitat, which is the human home, the human jungle. Mm-hmm. And that was how they went about setting up all of their studies. This is where they live, is with us.
Yes.
Yeah, about my only contribution, it's not research, but I live with retired racing greyhounds.
Oh, cool.
And the anecdote is, many people, I think, have the mistaken notion that the dogs are cruelly forced to run somehow.
Oh, yeah.
And living with them, I know that the one thing that they enjoy most in life, aside from sleeping and eating, is running. Yes. And they get so much joy from it, and we get joy from watching it.
Yes.
You get the idea that people who wrote about, you know, animal cognition 30 or 40 years ago had never watched the animals that they wrote about.
It's true.
Like, how can you think that
story along those lines. It always makes me laugh. But one time, Jane Goodall was being interviewed on a Good Morning America along with Nick Nichols, National Geographic photographer, and it was about orangutans. They were talking about that. And the females, some of the female orangutans will sneak away with their male partner who's sort of occupied their time for a while, and the females at great risk to themselves will sneak away very quietly and try to go off and have sex with some other guy. And they know if they get caught by their main partner that he's going to beat them up. And so Nick was explaining, the TV interviewer was saying, well, why do you think they do that? And Nick was giving the whole evolutionary biology explanation about how, you know, it was important to have different genes and so forth. And so then the interviewer asked Jane, why do you think they do it? And Jane just said, I think they do it because it's fun.
No, I was just going to say, girls, you want to have fun.
Sneak away because it's fun. I just laughed. I thought, now there's a woman who really understands animals. You know, we're not mm-hmm. robots. We're not completely driven by these evolutionary programs. We do want to have fun and sneaking away sometimes, even though it's dangerous, it's also thrilling. I remember talking to an evolutionary biologist about this, and he said scornfully, "Fun? What kind of advantage is having fun?" Well, since then I found out, you know, I met a researcher who I describe in my book, Yak Pangsep, who discovered that rats laugh. And you think of how long rats have been in research for 150 years.
I love that part of the book.
Thank you. And no one thought to ask, what are rats doing when they're playing? And he noticed that their little mouths are open. And he thought wisely, you know, they must be making a sound that we can't hear. And so he put a bat detector in and discovered they're laughing. So that led to his whole study of why laugh, why play. Laughter is obviously not something that came with our so-called higher emotions as we evolved as mammals. It's down there at the base. It's something that mammals do. They need to laugh and play. And yes, they need to have fun, even though some would wonder, why have fun? I mean, it's almost absurd. That was certainly the bias, you know, where all these little robots marching out there. Boy, life is dull. You can't have fun.
Well,
and yeah, then you see those videos of the ravens, you know, and I think probably all of you have seen those YouTube videos of the ravens in Russia, I think it is,
yeah,
or Poland, where they're sliding down the roofs, yeah, on the ice and the snow. It's so, they're obviously having fun. I'm sorry, go ahead.
They're doing something there. I have a question. So what struck me when reading What the Dog Knows is how young a science of body dogs is. I was like, the 70s, I was a girl, I was alive, you know? And so I'd like to ask both of you sort of to talk a little bit about the time frame of the science behind the working dog, the body dog, and then Virginia, of animal cognition, so that, you know, people get a good sense of, you know, when did this become acceptable to start looking into this?
Yes, and there's still people who say it's not. You know, that's the interesting thing, is those who insist that they have to, as one put it to me, we really have to rein in these evolutionary biologists who have now given minds to animals.
You know, I mean, I think, Joanne, this is science has lagged really far, far behind on the issue of working dogs. And the fact is that one of the most fascinating things to me is watching as science starts to say, oh, wait a second, right? Mm-hmm. But it can be very hard to set up experiments. And I think that the Hungarians and the Czechs, who were some of the very first people who were working with sort of complex cognition and the recognition of that, were working with working dogs in Europe. And I think that it's important to sort of look at that and say, yes, Brian here in the United States, working in his garage as a graduate student with his dog being able to recognize that when he pointed, the dog would go to the cup, right?
And not just stare at your finger like a toddler.
The food. That's exactly right. But what's, I think, fascinating is, of course, the Europeans have a much longer history of working closely with dogs as working dogs. And as a result, I think that the science and scientists sort of acknowledging that dogs can solve complicated problems is a little further advanced. And I think Virginia can probably weigh in on this, but as you look at what's happening, being able to put a dog in a lab and have it sort of strut its stuff is a really difficult thing to do. And the acknowledgement that dogs can do this, if you look at, for instance, there's this marvelous set of studies where the Brits looked at dogs being able to recognize identical twins. And the Brits said, oh, yes, they can do it. And then they did identical twins that lived in the same house and had the same diet, and the dogs couldn't do it. And the Brits threw up their hands and said, ah, here's the limit, right? And then, of course, the Eastern Europeans came in with working dogs, with law enforcement German shepherds, who could, guess what, identify identical twins living in the same house, eating the same diet, right? And I think that what we're going to see in cognitive studies with dogs is that the more that we can get out of the lab, you know, and as Jane Goodall did with her observational studies, right, actually have scientists working alongside trainers and handlers of working canines, I think that you're going to see some really interesting advances. I'll be very interested to see what Virginia thinks about this, because you were over with Adam et al. And it must have been fascinating.
It really was. And I met Vilmos Csányi, too, who actually started the field of dog cognition research in Hungary. And he started it quite a bit before Brian Hare and his famous garage experiment study. But he was actually well known in animal cognition field for his studies on fish. But he felt that they'd gotten to a point where they'd answered everything. And he had, and his wife had recently acquired a little dog. And he would come to the lab every day. He was head of the lab. And so he would say to his students, you know, my dog did X this morning. Why do you suppose we did that? And the students would all look at one another, because dogs, this was in the 1980s, and dogs were just not an animal that you would consider to study from a cognitive standpoint, because they supposedly weren't real animals. They were something we had made.
And dog non grata.
Yes, so they didn't fulfill the criteria. So all of his students would look at one another with very sad faces, because they thought Vilmos had really gone off the deep end asking these questions about dogs, and his dog in particular. And then he would say, making it even worse, he'd say, you boys figure out an experiment to figure out why my dog can do that. And so they were really beside themselves. And finally, he closed the lab entirely, the fish lab, and said, no, we're just going to study dogs. And they thought for sure they would be the laughing stock of all cognition studies. And then they began looking around, trying to find something they could study. And the first thing that they did, actually, was an experiment similar to the one that Brian Hare did with Michael Tomasello, the pointing test. And they also published, I think the two papers came out almost simultaneously, but the Hungarians were a step ahead, because they were also, they had an overarching framework in which they were studying the dog mind. And that was Vilmos' idea, that if we looked at dogs and their attachment to us and the way that they had come from wolves as their ancestors, that we would see in the dog, probably we could see the dog as a better example of our own evolutionary history than studying chimpanzees and comparing them to us. That the dog was probably a better model for what the kind of domestication had done to the human animal. Yes. And so he had this overarching idea, and then it was, okay, the dog is something unique. It's more like us than even a chimpanzee, and it's an animal that lives with us, it lives in our home, and so it has this very, very special evolutionary history. And all of their studies have been done to sort of explore aspects of that question. And I think it's one reason that they then went ahead and had the first dog cognition conference and have really led the field in asking a lot of the most interesting questions. And when I was there, they were doing a test, and they also set up the model which is used. And they realized what, as they set things up, that they couldn't have a kennel full of dogs, that that wasn't going to be the way to get into the dog's mind, because dogs live with someone. And they couldn't go into people's homes necessarily. And they tried first with shelter dogs, but the shelter dogs, they know what's fair, and they didn't like it if one dog kept getting chosen for a test. Mm. And so then they would beat that dog up. And so
dogs.
The scientists realized they were causing problems at the shelter, and one of them went to I think somebody in the lab was doing dog agility, and they went there and they found all of these owners who were just delighted to then bring their dogs in and have them used in tests. And so they set it up, the owner is there with the dog, so the dog feels comfortable, and then they give them these different kind of tests. So when I was there, they were doing one to see how dogs respond to a sound of a food growl, which other dogs make. And they had this woman had her little Yorkshire Terrier, and the dog was allowed to go forward. It just saw this big chunk of meat in front of a cage that was covered with a cloth. And just as it got a few steps away from getting that beautiful chunk of meat, suddenly this growl was made, which was like, that's my bone, leave it alone. And so the little Yorkshire Terrier stopped in his tracks and turned and looked over his shoulder at his owner, which is what, you know, it's like, Mom, help me out here. Are you going to come with me and help me get that piece of food? And that was one of the things the Hungarians were really interested in. It was the way that dogs, when they have a problem, they don't try to figure it out on their own. They look back at us. They turn to us. Help me out here. Let's do this together.
Well, aren't scientists working against, I don't know, decades, centuries, whatever, of bias that comes from this ladder of evolution with humans at the pinnacle where all the animals are dumb and things, and dogs are too familiar, so we can't study them, they can't possibly think, they can't do this. And you can't study and ask the questions unless you think of the questions first.
Well, that attitude, though, is actually only lasted for about 70 years. Because Darwin, when he first set out the theory of natural selection and sexual selection, he never said that humans were the top of the pile. He said there were different lineages. And then his second book, which was on the expressions of emotions in man and the animals, was actually the first attempt to do comparative psychology. Mm. And he did it with anecdotes and observations that he'd made of especially of his own dogs. And then later he was attacked for doing that and saying this wasn't rigorous science. And the field shifted. It was taken over by psychologists rather than biologists. And you had this whole era of about 70 years where, there was even a question as to whether humans think, if everything isn't just a stimulus and a response, and that there wasn't any mind making decisions or any intention or desires. And once that shifted for humans and we recognized, okay, we take in information, we process it, and even desires or wants can be triggers for making us do things, or that we have intentions, we have desires, and those influence our behaviors, then it began to be shown that, yes, animals, of course, do the same things because there's an evolutionary past to all of our abilities, cognitive, emotional, whatever.
Yeah. You know, I want to come back to an interesting point that Virginia made about the little Yorkie.
Yes.
And the food growl and the piece of meat. And one of the things that I think distinguishes some of the working dogs from that little Yorkie is the degree to which you have to build up that bond between owner and dog. So that Yorkie looking back and saying, come help me, mommy, is inherently something most pet owners want in their dogs, right?
If
the dog comes and he like looks at you and says, hey, open the damn gate. I want to get out. Right? Yes. So one of the sort of fascinating and inherent contradictions with working dogs is that you are constantly working to both build that bond, that communication between you and the dog, and then simultaneously you're trying to make sure that they're independent. Because, as Virginia said, there's a point at which, for a working dog, you want that dog to actually be making independent decisions. And I think what people can see this very often, again, with herding dogs, because it's very easy to see what they're doing, is that their handler is giving some basic directions. But that dog is out there making microsecond decisions all on its own, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what good working dogs do. And so, you know, and this is what actually ends up irritating me with Coda, our new pup, who's now 14 months old, in that I'm trying to build her independence, but also her bond with me. But part of her independence is that she goes through the house and she opens doors. Right? This is not a desirable behavior for most dogs. Or she'll come into a building, an abandoned building, and the first thing she does in searching for scent is she just levitates onto counters and tables, right?
Oh, yes.
And in any other context, people would be saying, bad dog, off, off, off. And I'm just zipping my lip because I want her to see the world as brilliantly three-dimensional. And I want her coming into a building to, sure, occasionally if I open my mouth and make a peep, I want her to look back at me. But other than that, I want her to be thinking about her job, right? And so it's a fascinating thing where you want to build that dog up and bond with you so that it can then go out in the world, right? And that's when those partnerships that you see of working dogs that seem to do things that our pet dogs don't, it's that simultaneous close bond plus, right? And I think the Yorkie brings it to mind because Solo's still at the point where if he can't get to something, right, and he's tried it, he'll come back to me and say, hey, get over here. Yes. I need you to pull this thing out from where I can't get at it.
So the dogs are doing, both the herding dogs, your scent-seeking dogs, the cadaver dog, are all doing taking guidance, but they're doing very high-level task-oriented things. And I loved it when you said, Kat, when you wrote about one person telling you you were watching a dog working. I don't think it was Solo. And the person said to you, well, he's in the middle of solving a very complex scent problem. And it's like, wow. You know, and that not only is that, you know, personal story, but it also is underscoring the science that you're talking about of reinforcing this cognitive idea that we're talking about, this newish idea that the dogs, you give the task to the dog that says find, you know, look here and first and find these things, but the dog then has to solve all of those problems to carry out that task.
Yeah, and I'll give you just
pretty complicated.
It is a little, I'll give you just a recent example, and it was just a demo, but it was in front of a class of high school students out in their parking lot. And, you know, high school students can be a very hard audience to please. And Solo was doing a simple little demonstration, and I had put just a piece of carpet that had come from underneath a body, and I had just set it in the drain. And another thing a little further away. And I sent Solo out, and he fairly quickly worked the scent cone down to where the carpet was sitting down inside the drain. And I said, good boy, gave him his tug toy, released him to continue the search. And I saw him go to the far side of the parking lot, and I looked, and there was a drain there, and it was the outflow of the other drain. It was about 20 yards away. He went over, he smelled it. He looked puzzled. He went around a little. Then he came back to the original scent source and said, no, this is the same smell. It just vented out. Now, my pup would never have understood that. She would have actually got caught in that weaker scent, right? Mm. She would have remained trapped there. Solo has experienced enough that it's sort of like two ends of a culvert, right? He knows which end of the culvert he needs to alert on or give his final indication, right? He knows when he goes to the other end and there is scent there that it's the exact same scent on that particular thing that he's looking for. And that, in a way, is just a good indication of saying this is how dogs, as they get more experienced, are able to think about those things and then say, wait, I've got the answer.
Mm-hmm. Right. And does experience even figure into the evolutionary biologist's rather limited theory of mind for dogs?
Oh, well, I don't know about dogs, but certainly for other animals. And it's not evolutionary biologists who have a limited idea about animals. It's really the human psychologist, the comparative psychologist to a certain degree, but there's been sort of a marriage between sort of more open-minded comparative psychologists and evolutionary biologists, and there's a field called cognitive ethology now, which is really making great strides. And so people, or behavioral ethology or behavioral ecology, and people working in those fields will definitely say that an animal's experience is important in making in how it makes decisions. They know that especially from studies that have been done on elephants. And Cynthia Moss and Karen McComb, Joyce Poole, have done a big study in Amboseli National Park with the elephant herd there, in which they were able to show that the oldest matriarchs in the herds which had matriarchs of, say, 55 years and older, those females, I was almost going to say women, those female elephants make the best decisions, and as a result of making the best decisions, then their herd members have more calves and raise more offspring, so there are evolutionary benefits to that. And herds that have younger females that are, say, 30, 40, 45, even 50 years old, are not as adept at making decisions as mm-hmm. are the older ones. And they can clearly show that. And they just did another study comparing the young elephants who were taken from culls in South Africa. They killed all the other family members, the wildlife officials did, and then took the 4 to 10-year-olds and put them in parks without elephants or with very few elephants and just sort of left them out there to get along on their own. And we know that after the males reached puberty that they began attacking and killing rhinoceroses. So that was something no one had ever seen before, an elephant killing a rhino. And they, Joyce Poole, who is an expert on male elephants, advised them to bring in older adult males who then sort of their testosterone levels influenced the younger males, so their testosterone levels then were not as high as before, and they also learned how to behave as an adult male. But the females, now it's 20, 30 years on, they just do not know how to make the right social decisions. And mm-hmm. they did a very, very interesting study that just came out a couple of weeks ago in the Journal of Frontiers of Experimental Biology, and they showed that those that are 30 years old, they cannot recognize the call of a dominant strange female, which could be a real danger, mm-hmm. and they will run away from the call of a friend, and it's just all over the map how they respond. There's no consistency. So these results, the negative effect of the culling continues to go on. So yeah, experiences matter.
Yeah. If you don't mind me popping over to an audience question.
Good.
I guess it could be science, however you want to. Here's someone, he thinks you were basically saying you don't think love is a reward. I trained my pet with no reward but approval, verbal, physical, etc., effectively love. How would you address that statement?
Well, I think that this is the lovely thing about dogs. They're all different. And one of the things that you learn as you train a variety of different dogs is they like different things. Solo likes my approval, but my relationship with him is greatly built with toys and then stuff transfers. He doesn't want petting. He actually, praise to him is really the tug toy. That's Solo. It's not that he's simple. That's what turns him on most of all. And what we do, I think, as good owners and trainers and handlers is we take what the dog likes and we build that more. Little Coda, my young pup who's 14 months old, is not nearly as toy-driven. She actually really responds to physical praise and love. She actually likes to be hugged and touched. Solo, sort of like, oh no, 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 no. I'm over here, you're over here. I mean, sometimes he'll put his head on my knee very briefly, but Coda likes to snuggle in. And one of her rewards is she likes to jump up on me and get a full body hug. And so when she does something and I approve of it, that's part of her reward. And so what I would say to this person is, yes, love is clearly at the heart of what we do with dogs and what dogs do with us. But one of the things that we do with love with people as well is we try to give them the things that they love, right? That's part of the relationship. And so what I would say is that Solo probably would have flipped me off long ago if I had just said, good dog. So we'll see. Coda, if I try to reward her right now without giving her a desiccated liver treat at the source scent, right, she looks at me and she goes, what, a toy? No. A pet? No. I want that liver.
So part of your training is finding out what it is that the dog loves so that you can arrive at that together.
You know, it's a relationship, right? And all relationships are different. And yes, dogs have a lot of things in common, but one of the things that we talk about is second dog syndrome with handlers who have one dog that works a particular way and responds a particular way, and then you come in with a new dog, and actually that training method doesn't work at all. Mm-hmm. And you think, I'm a failure, or more often you think the dog's a failure, right? And what it is that you have not found a way to build your communication and relationship with that new dog. And so what I think is wonderful is being able to figure out, it's not a difference between Labradors and Shepherds, right? Or a mixed breed and something else. It's that particular dog. And that's actually part of the joy of the relationship, is that it is so complicated. I'm still trying to fall in love with Coda. I'm not entirely in love with her. I'm completely in love with Solo, right? And part of that is that we haven't maximized our communication because she's still young and I'm still learning.
And every dog has its own personality. I did a piece recently for Psychology Today about personality in animals and talked to some dog researchers who tried to identify breed-specific personalities, because oftentimes we hear, you know, German Shepherds are like this or Collies are like that. But in fact, he said they're not. You know, every dog has its own personality. And so he said what he ends up telling people who are just looking for a good companion dog is to choose the happy dog. Find a dog with a happy personality, and then you're going to have a good dog. And I thought that makes it so simple. And I think about how when we were looking for our second dog and we wanted a mixed collie because our previous dog had been a mixed collie, so of course we loved her and we wanted to love our new dog. And we found a woman, there were a whole group of people working, bringing back a good American working farm collie. And so I asked, well, we just want to have a dog who has a good sense of fun and is mischievous, because that was one trait we really loved in our other dog. And this woman said, well, I'm going to give you this young pup named Reuben. And she named all of her puppies after the contestants in American Idol. he was named for Reuben's daughter.
I thought it was going to be the great painter.
No, these are the American Idol puppies. And I knew, you know, that all of the dogs had to be great if she named her dogs. I knew she just had to have a good sense of humor, and Buck does. He just keeps us laughing. He just does something silly, and he is the most social dog. He can get other dogs to play who the owner will say, my dog doesn't play, and then Buck does this very, very funny, expressive, over-the-top dog bow play bow, and rolls his eyes, and the next thing you know, they're all playing together. We brought him to Oregon. He is from Arkansas, and his name was Reuben, which is fine in Arkansas, but maybe not so fine in Oregon. So here we gave him a name for Oregon cowboy, Buckaroo. So a little bit of the Roo sound.
So this is related to another question that came in. And you did sort of answer it, look for the fun animal, whatever, the happy animal. But here's someone saying, what sort of dog would you recommend for a single person? Boy, isn't that a tough one, and, you know, how do you choose a dog?
That is hard, yeah.
It's very hard. And, you know, I think that one chooses dogs based on a variety of nostalgic reasons and historical reasons and media reasons, and I think that all those reasons can be good, but I think that they're not the best way to choose a dog. And part of it is that issue of being very realistic about what you can give the dog, not just what the dog can give mm-hmm. you. And I think all of us have these sort of childhood fantasies of, you know, sort of the ideal heroic dog or whatever. I mean, my parents got me a miniature dachshund when I was a child, and I wanted an Irish wolfhound. But I was very small. I was a very small child. And I ended up with a miniature dachshund. And the fact is that it wasn't a good dog for me ever, but partly because of the expectations I brought. But in a way, it was a very practical choice that my parents said is, here's a small kid, here's a dog that is her size that won't need a lot of exercise. And I think that those are the things that you think of. And for a single person, look, I had two German Shepherds as a single person. I mean, but it's also true that I traveled as a reporter. I had a flexible schedule. The dogs came with me a lot. They were actually not home alone. And I think it's enormously important for single people to think about the issue of leaving a dog home alone. There are a few breeds that can be alone for a period of hours, and as Virginia said, it really depends on the dog. And I think that you have to sort of assess what you've got in terms of exercise, place, and space, and ability to exercise a dog, and to remember always that cognitive exercise can be as important as taking a dog jogging for 3 miles.
Or not even jogging.
Don't necessarily need that, especially in North
to walk around the neighborhood so they can smell things and see stuff and do something that's different from being in the house, I think.
I mean, the mental stimulation can be absolutely as important as the physical exercise.
It is. I still go back to Adam McCloskey and his comment to me, which was, the dog is not a lamp. You know, that's not why you brought one into your home, is to stick it in the corner. And I think many people make the mistake of thinking they're going to have a dog and forgetting that they have a job. And if your job doesn't allow you to, say, bring the dog to your office or to somehow have the dog with you for a good part of the day, I think it's a disservice to the dog. I mean, I'm very fortunate in that my husband and I are both riders. We work at home, and so Buck is with us 24/7. And then if we both go away out on assignment or something, we take him to stay with his trainer. So he's still getting a lot of activity and getting to do fun things, and he loves her. But I just, the point I am now with a dog, I wouldn't leave my dog alone for any long stretch of time. I can just see how important it is to him that he be with us.
But dogs do vary, and so I would want to contribute the other side and say our greyhounds spend about 23 and a half hours of the day sleeping, and I'm concerned about people I see who say, well, I would really love to have a dog, but I work, and it wouldn't be fair to the dog.
Right.
And it's like, yes, what you say, Virginia, can be so true because the dog needs a certain expectation met. But I think there are some dogs who have modest expectations and are perfectly fine sleeping at home while we're at work.
Well,
our family time is when we get home, and that's enough for them because, you know, after an hour of, they like about 10 minutes worth of activity, and then they're back to sleeping.
I admit that I got a dog that one of the attractions was the fact that they said about the American Working Farm Collie is that they are Velcro dogs. And they will stick with you. And because we go off, we do a lot of hiking, and our previous dog was like this too because she was part collie, and she would run off to chase something and go a certain distance, but then it would be as if she'd hit a wall, and immediately she would stop and come back to be with us.
Mm.
And Buckaroo is the same way. You know, he's always knows where the herd is and wants more than anything to be with us. You know, he'll go off and play or chase squirrels or whatever, and he listens so well. I don't want him chasing deer, and so he's learned, you know, we can watch the deer, but aren't going to chase him. And so that's remarkable to me that a dog will override his own desire, especially a herding dog. Anything moving, you know, is worth chasing.
that, that prey drive is.
It's no, very strong.
I do think you make a really important point, and that is that all dogs are different. And, you know, yes. One of the things that Virginia is talking about, the fact is that I build in time of the dogs being alone in their crates in the car, because inevitably on training and searches, the dogs need to be able to spend time alone and mm-hmm. to not have separation anxiety when we're not there. And so I build that up. Is it their favorite thing to do? Probably not. But I also love the fact that with Coda, I can put her in the crate in the car, even as a young pup, and come back 3 hours later, and she's sleeping, and she gets up and stretches and yawns and says, okay, let's go. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, as everybody said, all dogs are different. All dogs have different needs. But mm-hmm. for me, I actually purposefully build up a little less of some of the Velcro, mm-hmm. partly because those are the conditions. I mean,
right.
And
Kat, don't you think also that dogs really respond better when they have a routine, a set routine, where mm-hmm. there's sort of a consistency to their days and they know what to expect?
Yeah, and here I'm going to break all the rules and say that for working dogs, you try to break up all that consistency.
Interesting.
And
yeah.
You try to do it because partly you need them to get used to sort of chaotic environments that are not expected.
The unexpected, right?
The unexpected, yeah. And moving them in and out of hotel rooms, in and out of cars, and even where, gosh, you're not going to eat at 5, you're going to eat at 7. Mm-hmm. And so I think that where the consistency comes in, of course, is the consistency of your being with them, your working with them, and inevitably they're realizing that mm-hmm. I will get fed, I will get rewarded,
mm-hmm.
I
yes.
will, right.
But when they're working, you need them to be confident and independent.
Yes, and I need them to not stress. I need them to not feel stressed out by changed circumstances. Right,
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
a bit unique as opposed to pets.
Okay, so I've got one more question from the audience. It could be a long answer, but I'd like if you can sort of shorten it, and then Jeff and I will probably finish with some final questions here. But so this is more complex, and I can sort of see how Virginia might be in the better position to answer, but Kat, of course, you're willing to.
Oh, Kat's good.
Okay, dogs are apparently descended from Eurasian wolves. But I gather that modern science believes they are a changed animal. Would you care to address the difference between and similarities between dogs and wolves? How might the study of the taming of foxes relate? And I don't know anything about that.
Oh, yes. Well, there is a wonderful study that's been done in Russia that's been going on for I don't know how many generations now, but the original idea was to see if they could get something dog-like if you just selected the silver fox puppies that were the most friendly to humans, the tamest, the ones who would come toward people and not run back to the back of their cages. And so the people who worked on that project ended up creating a animal that is very much not only physically like a dog in the way that its coat then became spotted, its tail curled, it got floppy ears, a little more pushed in face, but it loves people. These silver foxes want to leap into your arms and be with you. They were Velcro foxes that were created, but human Velcro foxes. And so, yes, this is probably somewhat similar to what happened with when the wolf became the dog. And we don't know exactly how that transpired. There's some thinking that there were animals, say, around 30, 40,000 years ago that were wolves or wolf-like animals that hung around the camps where humans were killing mammoths and hunting. And so they were the scavengers and were kind of the garbage detail. And that some of those then lost their fear of people and began to hang out and help along with on mammoth hunts. So you see like a big dog that would go forward and hold the mammoth and keep it there by barking or jumping around it and kind of draw attention while the people killed it, that kind of a scenario. And we, other than that, you know, and even that idea is just sheer guessing. We really don't know. We do know that in that in more less developed cultures that dogs are sort of the garbage collectors of the villages and killing up everything from human waste to bones that are tossed out. That's really what they eat. And so if that was the way that wolves became dogs, that can explain a lot of some of the behaviors that we don't necessarily appreciate about our own animals. I don't know. Anybody who's taken a dog for a walk in the woods, sometimes is surprised at what they bring back to share with you.
I want to use up my last little question. I have a specific little question for Kat from reading your book. Because Temple Grandin was a guest here, and we talked to her, and of course we talked a lot about autism, and it's easy to forget, she's so compelling about that topic, that she has been, I hate to say it, but a real animal researcher, and you referred to her work on whorls in cattle chest fur, and I thought, how extraordinarily interesting! And yes. Could you, make a brief comment about that? Just so, people do study this, and there's something to be studied, and she did it.
They do, and I think that the science is not finalized on this. I think that what's interesting is that this has to do with left brain, right brain lateralization issues, and but remember that some of this early research, for instance, on left-handed people versus right-handed people, how badly some of that research turned out. And what she was noting is that depending on the direction of the whorls, because hair always comes together at a certain spot, right, and then goes in a particular direction. That
mathematicians have had quite a bit to say about that.
That's right, and that certain steers that had whorls in one direction were tamer than those with whorls in the other direction, and so a veterinary researcher in Australia did a little bit of work. Again, small samples on dogs that were to become guide dogs for the blind, and noted that dogs with a particular whorl direction tended to pass at higher rates to be appropriate guide dogs.
Yeah.
So I have to say, I have a husband who's left-handed. He remembers as a child the doctor pointing at his whorl and saying this is going to be a lefty.
Interesting.
And some of the research hasn't entirely held up on this, but I do think it was so marvelously evocative that I couldn't help noting it.
So we have gone a little past an hour, and it's so wonderful to talk to you guys and listen to you. And I've really had a great time. I've had to put my thing on mute because they're vacuuming leaves next door. I think I'm about ready to run outside with like $20 and go, can you vacuum my yard too then? You're going to make all this noise. But this is so fascinating. And both of your books were incredible. So Virginia Morell's Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures was marvelous. It was a great summer read. And Kat Warren's, you've got it. Okay.
I've got What the Dog Knows with a lovely picture of Solo right here on the cover.
Well, I have to show my lovely picture of Buck inside my book. I don't know if people can see that.
Yes.
But there's Buck.
There he is.
Yes, and that's your profile picture all over the place. So.
There's my cute buck.
If you follow these two ladies, you will see their dogs, whether you follow them on Twitter or Facebook.
It's true. It's really sad.
Dogs are lives.
When I go for a walk with Buck, people will say, oh, your dog is so beautiful. And so I realized I just have to take a back seat to beautiful Buck.
Yeah, that is a beautiful dog for sure. Yeah, we had a lovely black lab for the kids, and she lived 14 years, but she was the best dog for kids.
Yes.
As they
say. And she was happy.
She was
happy. I bet she was a happy dog.
She was happy, and I traded, oddly enough, I traded Cheerios on the floor for black dog fur. You know, it's like the dog managed to clean up whatever the kids managed to leave
there
behind, but I had to continually clean up dog fur. But
working
yeah, the
dog,
kids,
a vacuum cleaner.
Yep, it was just
small
such
price.
A wonderful experience for the kids. Four kids and a black lab. I mean, this dog was...
It sounds like a title of a book.
It is. for this dog, I tell you, so... but yeah, her job was keeping the kid. I mean, just you know, a companion for the kids. It was wonderful. So anyway,
we're going to talk about that dog when we talk with your kids. I think.
Yeah, we do. We do need to talk to my kids. Yeah. Get them all online. But thank you, Kat and Virginia. What a lovely topic for this Thanksgiving week here
thank
in America.
You.
And for answering audience questions. I appreciate people sending those in.
Yes.
And definitely you guys can check this out on YouTube later. So,
thank you, Joanne. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank
and
you.
Lovely to meet you, Virginia.
Lovely to meet you, too, Kat. And thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much, Joanne. Thanks for inviting me. It was real fun. And thanks to the audience.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks, Joanne. Back to you.
Thank you. All right. Signing off.
Bye.